Morning. So nice to see all of you. I was asked to announce that this morning's shiur is being generously sponsored by Esther Bartov in the merit of an aliyah from the neshama of her father, Shmuel Yaakov ben Pinchas Shraga. Alav HaShalom, Shetayi Nishmatat Tzura B'Tzor HaChayim. So thank you. If you've been following the news out of Ethiopia, you know that the country is involved in a war that began just 1 year ago in November of 2020. This is a region that has experienced conflict throughout the years, the decades. This is really a war-torn region, but the most recent conflict began just a year ago in the Tigray region in the north, which has always been a hotbed of political unrest and civil war. It's really been a war-torn region for decades. And in fact, the situation is getting so bad that the rebel troops are advancing now towards the nation's capital, Addis Ababa, and there's a fear that there's going to really be a full-out war, not just a skirmish or a regional conflict that is limited to that region in the north, the Tigray region, but an all-out war. And this, of course, endangers the lives of the remaining Ethiopian Jewish community, the remaining Jewish community in Ethiopia, in Gondar in the north, which has already been threatened, but now the community that's in Addis Ababa, the nation's capital. And as some of you know, the Ethiopian community is a community that's near and dear to my heart. I've been there a number of times, teaching, volunteering, spending time there. And so I'd like to speak about the status of Ethiopian Jewry and perhaps share some reflections from my visits to Ethiopia and from my interactions with this very special community. Just last week, President Buzi Herzog, during Sigd, which is a holiday that the Ethiopian Jews celebrate, he called on the government to make good on their promise and bring the remaining Jews of Ethiopia home in November of 2015. So we're talking about basically 6 years to the day. In November of 2015, the Knesset passed a decision, a formal decision to bring on Aliyah, the remaining community, but has failed to implement their decision or has not yet implemented their decision. It's been a long haul, a long process, and all along advocates for the community have been calling on the government to bring them on Aliyah. Over the past year, Israel conducted their most recent Mifza, most recent operation, Operation Tsuri Yisrael, Rock of Israel, that saw the Aliyah of 2,000 new immigrants from Ethiopia. This is amidst a global pandemic and this conflict in the north, which at that time was just in the north and threatening the Jews in Gondar. But there was a feeling that that we really need, both in light of the pandemic and the threat that that imposes to a community with very limited access to medicine, to health, plus this civil or political unrest, this war that's taking place in the north. There's a feeling that we have to start getting them out, and it was really the work of the current Minister of Aliyah and Absorption, Penina Tamanashato, who herself is a member of that community. She came on Aliyah as a very small child during Operation Moses, which took place between 1984 and 1985. So she herself is a member of the Eidah, member of the community. In fact, the first minister from the Ethiopian community, the first Ethiopian minister, and has done very important work to try to make sure that the rest of the community comes on Aliyah. There's still remaining, after this most recent Mifza, this most recent operation, there's still remaining about 5,500, estimated 5,500 between the nation's capital, Addis Ababa, and Gondar in the north. There are more in Gondar. And there's now a real concern that Israel needs to move to get them out, because who knows what's going to be. I know firsthand of stories of people not being able to reach their relatives, for instance, in Gaza because of the current situation there, and it's very scary. However, if you saw the news, this was reported in both the Hebrew media and the English media here in Israel, that yesterday and today, that the last airlift of some 61 Ethiopians, among them were non-Jews and even potentially members of rebel forces and war criminals. So the prime minister of Ethiopia yesterday called on Israel to return any and all rebel forces, war criminals, people responsible for war crimes taking place in that region, and Israel has already promised to do so. But this of course adds to the confusion of you know, are these people Jewish? Who's coming on Aliyah? Are they really members of the Jewish community, or are they opportunists just trying to take advantage? And that's one of the questions that I'd like to deal with together with you this morning. What is the halachic status of Ethiopians Jews? You know, and unfortunately, based on the reports that among this group of 61 Olim that came as part of this last crop a number of months ago, that there are non-Jews, a good portion of them could be not members of the Jewish community. So unfortunately, there are many that are calling on the government to stop and cease all future aliyot of members of Ethiopia's Jewish community, which is a shame and a real tragedy. And the minister of Aliyah and Absorption, Pnina Tamanashato, I mentioned herself, is a member of the Ethiopian community. She threatened to resign if Israel would make such a decision and not bring the rest over. So it's a very confusing situation. It's a very tense situation. There's an imminent threat which requires our assistance, requires our help. On the other hand, we have to be careful who we're bringing into the country. Very, very difficult situation. Very precarious situation. I'm sorry? Is the report true? Well, we don't know. We don't know. It's currently being investigated, but there is a concern. And if you look, this was reported in Ynet and Times of Israel, that there's a real concern that the last group of 61 that were rescued from this war-torn region in recent weeks, there's serious doubts regarding the majority of them, their status as Jews. So it's a real question. And then I said, you know, among them, perhaps even rebel fighters, rebel leaders, war criminals. And so just yesterday, you know, it was reported that the prime minister of Ethiopia, he complained in a phone call to Prime Minister Bennett that some of those airlifted were in fact officers involved in war crimes. And as I said, Israel promised to bring them home, to return them. We want to help Ethiopian Jews. We don't want to help war criminals, obviously. But, you know, for me, these reports are additionally painful and damaging because they give fodder to those voices who question the status of all Ethiopians Jewry. And we'll see. Their history is fascinating, but it's not so clear and requires attention. And so this morning, we'll take a look at some of the attitudes of the leading poskim, the poskei ador, the great authorities of the 20th century towards Ethiopian Aliyah. Okay? So first of all, a little history. How did the Jews get to Ethiopia? What is their origin story, so to speak? So there are actually two traditions which are both rooted in our tradition, both rooted in Tanakh. According to one tradition, King Solomon, Melech Shlomo, and the Queen of Sheba had a child who became Menelik I, the first great king of the Ethiopian Empire, the first of the Solomonic dynasty, even their celebrated leader, Haile Selassie, emperor, king, whatever, traced his lineage to King Solomon. And as I'll mention in a moment, you see throughout Ethiopia, even today, that they are constantly invoking this idea of how their leaders, their kings, were all part of the Solomonic dynasty, all descendants of King Solomon. They have, you know, their symbol is everywhere of the lion, which represents King Shlomo and Shlomo's temple and Jerusalem. These are major themes and motifs and symbols you see woven throughout the fabric of Ethiopia, even today, in their culture, in their folk art. But according to this legend, this story about how King Shlomo had a child with the Queen of Sheba, Menelik, the son of Shlomo, according to their tradition, travels to Jerusalem and visits with his father, King Shlomo. And Shlomo sends him back with all sorts of gifts and servants from Israel, Jewish servants, who then, according to this tradition, subsequently become the Jewish community in Ethiopia. Now, we'll see in a moment, while we have a passage in both Sefer Melachim, Melachim Aleph, Perek Yud, Kings 1, chapter 10, and Divrei Hayamim Bet, Perek Tet, Chronicles 2, or the second book of Chronicles, chapter 9. Well, we have such a tradition that the Queen of Sheba meets with Shlomo, and they have some sort of interaction that we'll see. And there's some conversation between the two of them, some wisdom exchanged, some gifts exchanged. There's no evidence that they had a child together, as we'll see in a moment. But as I said, you know, this is very much woven into the fabric of the cultural consciousness in Ethiopia. It's part of their history that their great kings descend from King Solomon. Even again, into the 20th century with Haile Selassie, the last of the Solomonic dynasty. And it's in their art, it's in their folk art. If you visit the National Museum of Ethiopia, as I have, you see that along, Lucy, the missing link, this 3.2 million year old hominin, and bones of early Homo sapiens that they have displayed. You see their folk art. They've got pictures and panels depicting King Solomon and his lions and his scepter and the Queen of Sheba and their interactions, including panels that depict how King Shlomo seduces the Queen of Sheba. Ultimately, they have this child who becomes their first great king, Menelik. And so you see these depictions. But again, there's no evidence in our Tanakh that they had a child together. And in fact, if you look at source number one, okay, this is from Sefer Melachim, Melachim Aleph, Perek Yud. As I said, there's a parallel passage in Divrei Hayamim Bet, Perek Tet, there in source number two. But let's just read a few lines together from Melachim Aleph in source number one. Okay. There the Tanakh describes Umalkat Shva Shomat et Shema Shlomo L'Shem Hashem V'Tavo L'Nasoto B'Chidot. The Queen of Sheba heard of King Solomon's name, his fame, through the name of Hashem, and she came to visit him and to test him with all sorts of riddles. King Solomon, of course, was Chacham Mikol Adam, the wisest of all men, so she heard of his great wisdom, and she wanted to see for herself if it's true. And so she asked him all sorts of questions, all sorts of riddles, perhaps philosophical questions. And so the Tanakh continues how she arrives there in Yerushalayim with camels bearing spices and great quantities of gold and all sorts of precious stones. And she came to him with the bere lav et kol asher haya im levava. And she spoke with him and asked him all that was on her heart, all that was on her mind. Vayeged la Shlomo et kol devareha. And Shlomo gave her all the answers, everything she wanted to know. Lo haya davar ne'elam min ha'melech asher lo higid la. There was nothing that the king did not know, nothing that he failed to share with her, nothing that he could not answer. And she was very impressed with his wisdom. She was impressed with his wisdom and with his palace, the palace that he built, and what was on his table and his court and all of his attendants, and even the korbanot, incredible, made an impression on her. This is a wonderful expression. She was even impressed with all the olot, all the burnt offerings, the elevation offerings that he brought to God in the Beit HaMikdash. And she, v'lo hayava od ruach. How would you translate that? She was left breathless, speechless. It took her breath away, right? And she said to him, wow, emet hayadavar asher shamati be'artzi al divarecha v'al chochmatecha. It's true, all that I heard about you and your wisdom. It's true. And she said, yeah, I did not initially believe the reports until I came and I saw it with my own two eyes. And, you know, even half of what was told to me, I did not believe. But now that I saw your wisdom and your wealth, it far surpasses even what I heard. And then she says, how fortunate are you and your men and all of your court that they surround you and could hear your wisdom. And then she begins to bless Hashem, praise Hashem, who placed you on the throne of Israel, okay, made you a king. And then it describes how she gave him all sorts of gifts, 120 talents of gold and spices and precious stones. And the Tanakh describes it. There was never again did they see such a great amount of spices as when Malkat Shva, the Queen of Sheba, gave to King Solomon. Okay. And then just skipping, it describes how he returned the gifts. He returned the favor and gave her gifts as well to bring back with her. He in turn gave her gifts and asked and answered everything that she wanted to know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that's the description that we have here. And as I said, you have a parallel passage in Divrei Hayamim. Okay, so you have this rich description of this wonderful interaction that the two of them have, but no description that they were married, no description that they had a child, no evidence that they had a child. Yet there is a tradition that they indeed had a child. He comes to visit King Shlomo, and Shlomo sends him back with more gifts and with servants, and those become the Jewish community in Ethiopia. That's one tradition. But then there's the more popular tradition, and that is that the Jews of Ethiopia descend from the tribe of Dan, one of the lost tribes, conquered by Sancheriv, Melech Ashur, the Assyrian Empire, in the 8th century BCE. And this, of course, is described in Sefer Malachim, that after the death of Shlomo HaMelech, the kingdom was split. You had the northern kingdom, Malchut Yisrael in the north, Malchut Yudah in the south. This is around 931 BCE. And Yeravam, his name even implies he caused a reeve, a split, a fight within the nation, proclaims himself king. And then, of course, the northern kingdom is conquered by the Assyrian Empire, by Sancheriv Melech Ashur. And in the language of the Mishnah in Masechet Yadayim, in the 4th chapter, Allah Sancheriv Melech Ashur ubilbel et kol ha'umot. Sancheriv had this scorched earth policy. He would conquer nations and he would scatter them across the four corners of the world. Why would he scatter nations? Any suggestions? Yes. It's pretty obvious. They could not rebel. If you're dispersed, displaced, makes it much more difficult to rebel. Okay? And so that is the long-standing tradition. Where that comes from, we'll see in a moment. But unfortunately, as you all know, many question the status of Ethiopian Jews. Are they really Jews? Right? Or are they opportunists coming to Israel for a better life, to escape poverty, to escape famine, now to escape war? Okay, but you know, even that is nothing new. That's been going on for decades in that region. Are they just, you know, opportunists looking for a better life in the state of Israel? Or no, are they Are they sincere? Are they Jews? Do they want to return to their ancestral homeland and fulfill, you know, perhaps this promise of the ingathering of the exiles and something that they've hoped and longed for maybe thousands of years? So the earliest record of a Jewish community in Ethiopia, the earliest recorded record, the earliest printed record, the earliest record that we have in print comes from the 9th century. And from a 9th century work known as Sefer Eldad Hadani, literally from Dan. And Eldad documents his travels throughout North Africa and the Mediterranean. He visits communities and he weaves all these wonderful tales, these fantastic stories, and he teaches unique halachot and claims to come from this powerful independent Jewish kingdom in East Africa, comprised of the descendants of the tribes of Dan, Naphtali, Gad, and Asher. He mentions other lost tribes, their whereabouts, their history, makes references to sons of Moshe that also reside in Africa. And according to Eldad, the Jews of Ethiopia are indeed the descendants of the tribe of Dan. So that's where that tradition comes from. And following Eldad's visit, he creates quite a stir there in the 9th century. So following his visit to the Jewish community of Kirwan in Tunisia, the community sends a letter to one of the leading Gaonim. This is during the Tkufat Gaonim, Rav Tzemach Gaon of Sura. There were two great academies, of course, Sura and Pumbedita. And he questions this account. The community questions this account. Can they rely on him? Can they learn from him? Can they accept the halachot that he teaches? And Rav Tzemach Gaon replies that indeed his account is reliable, as are the halachot he teaches. So Rav Tzemach Gaon is the first posek, the first rabbi, the first authority to give his stamp of approval, so to speak, his gushpanka to this tradition that there are Jews in Ethiopia that are full-fledged Jews, okay? But later in his commentary to Sefer Shmot, the Ibn Ezra, Avram Ibn Ezra, questions the veracity in Sefer Eldad Hadani, as does the Maharam Mirotenberg in one of his tshuvot. So not all of the great Rishonim, for example, accepted this. However, Eldad Hadani is cited by Rashi. He's cited by the Ravid, Rabbeinu Asher, the Rashba, the Smag, Rabbi Avraham ben HaRambam, the Rambam's son, among others, as a reputable source. So there were many great Rishonim that did accept Eldad Hadani, who rely on his testimony and quote the halachot he taught. Some even refer to him as a rabbi. So you have already from the 9th century and on, through the medieval period, an affirmation of this tradition that there is a Jewish community in Ethiopia, that they are perhaps the descendants of Dan, and that this Eldad, who's traveling all over, he's coming with traditions that this community had maintained. Fast forward to the 12th century, and you have the Jewish traveler Benjamin of Tudela and the non-Jewish traveler Prester John, both traveling and describing their travels. They write travelogues. They record a presence of a Jewish community in Ethiopia. In the 16th century, actually not this, I'm sorry, this is the 15th century earlier, before we get to the 16th century. In the 15th century, you have records of the Jewish community in Ethiopia from Rav Avadia Mibartanura, who's famous for his commentary on the Mishnah, right? And so he has a letter to his father dated the 6th of Elul, 5248, that's August 15th, 1488. Okay, so 1488, 15th century. And he reports that when he was in Egypt, he saw dark-skinned Jews from Ethiopia who lacked the knowledge of the oral tradition of the Torah Sheba'al Peh and its traditions. So that would seem very consistent with what we know about the Jewish community in Ethiopia. They had an Orit, they had a Torah written in Gez, in this language that the Kesim, their rabbis, priests, spiritual leaders, understood and spoke, but they did not have a Torah Sheba'al Peh, which would affirm the tradition that they splintered off the Jewish community and did not, they had I guess at one point they had an oral tradition, but they forgot their oral tradition, right? Because it was oral. They did not have the recorded oral tradition, the Mishnah, the Gemara, Chazal, as we do. Why did Chazal write down the oral tradition, which was supposed to be kept oral? Torah Shebaal Peh is supposed to be kept Baal Peh, because they saw that the Jewish people were forgetting. So what the Bartanura, what Rabbi Ovadia Mi Bartanura writes, seems very consistent with what we know about today's Ethiopian Jewish community, how they lacked they had forgotten the oral tradition. He writes another letter the following year in Elul of 5249, August of 1489, to his brother, and reports that he met with Yemenite Jews in Jerusalem who confirmed that there are Jews in Ethiopia, as they described, beyond the river Sambation. Now, that is significant because we have a tradition that the 10 lost tribes were exiled beyond the river Sambation. That alludes to this river where, according to rabbinic tradition, the 10 lost tribes were exiled beyond. And it's a river that flows with rocks and boulders, so it can't be crossed, it can't be forged. It only quiets on Shabbat, but alas, you can't cross, you can't violate Chum Shabbat. So there's no escaping. Writing in the 16th century, the Radbaz, and this is crucial for our discussion this morning, and the status of the Ethiopian Jewish community, in accepting them as Jews or not, the Radbaz, Rabbi David ibn Shlomo ibn Zimra, who was a rabbi in Egypt and in Jerusalem and in Tzfat, and a very, very important authority, writes thousands of tshuvot. So he writes a number of tshuvot where he accepts the tradition of Eldad HaDani, and he writes that the Jews of Ethiopia are indeed the descendants of the tribe of Dan. He affirms this tradition of Eldad HaDani. In one tshuva, he's emphatic that they are unquestionably of Jewish lineage according to halacha. Okay, a student of his, Rav Yaakov Castro, issued a similar ruling in one of his tshuvot. So the Radbaz, as we'll see in a few moments, becomes very important because he writes a number of tshuvot where he affirms the tradition of Eldad HaDani, that the Ethiopian Jewish community are descendants of the tribe of Dan, and he accepts them as full-fledged Jews. That becomes important because that influences the opinion of Rav Avadi Yosef in the 20th century. Okay, now, in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, Christian missionary groups begin aggressively targeting the Jewish community in Ethiopia for conversion. I mean, in general, in the 19th and 20th centuries, you have missionaries coming over from Europe to Africa to try to, you know, civilize these primitive Africans and convert them to Christianity. And this was an aggressive attempt at missionizing the African communities, but you have those groups that were specifically targeting the Jewish community for conversion, and they document their missionary activities. And it's incredible. You have missionaries like Samuel Gobat, John Martin Flad, Henry Aaron Stern, describing the Jewish communities of Ethiopia and Eritrea. Eritrea is just the north of Ethiopia. How the Jews were living in these rural villages and documenting their missionary activities in these little tracts that they publish. And I've seen these little tracts, these little books. I've been through them at the National Library, the Sifri Alumit here in Jerusalem, and it's fascinating. You go through them and they're bragging how they are successfully missionizing to Jews. Now, it's a question of whether the Jews were forcibly converted or they were persuaded, they were intimidated, maybe they were starving to death. One of the tactics that the missionaries used was they would give them land in exchange for conversion. And, this is a region that has been plagued by famine and starvation, malnutrition. So it's very possible that they felt they had no choice but to convert to Christianity in order to receive this land which they could farm. But what's interesting, and this becomes important, very important for our conversation this morning, you have two groups that emerge. You have the Beta Israel, who are the first to come on Aliyah to Israel through Operations Brothers, Moses, Joshua, Solomon. And the Beta Israel were those who clung very strongly to their tradition and did not give in to these missionary attempts. They held strong to their faith. I've spoken to members of the community who, according to their tradition, they would very much try to limit their interactions with Gentiles. In general, if they would engage with a Gentile, they would immerse in a river. You know, they felt they somehow became impure if they had some interaction with a non-Jew. And what happens is the groups who came on Aliyah, who were part of this Beta Israel, they saw their co-religionists, those Jews who converted in the late 19th and early 20th centuries to Christianity, they saw them as rebels. They saw them as cowards, as traitors. Ad kedei kach that even today you have many in that community who advocate that the state of Israel not bring those Jews who become known as the Falash Mura on Aliyah, including their religious leaders, Kesim, who've come out and called on the state of Israel not to accept those Falash Mura who are waiting to make Aliyah in Gondar and in Addis Ababa, because they see them as traitors, really, as traitors, guilty of treason. It's very difficult. It's very difficult. And unfortunately, those who are against bringing the remaining Jewish community on Aliyah will often invoke this. They'll say, well, look, even their very own leaders, religious leaders and members of the Ethiopian community here in Israel are calling on the government not to accept them on Aliyah. So it becomes very difficult. But what we do know, and this is something that Rabbi Menachem Waldman has published on both in Hebrew and in English. This has been his life's work, the Jewish community of Ethiopia. And if not for him sending young people on Shlichut there today, there's really no one really attending to both the physical and spiritual needs of the communities there today, those Jews that are left. He's a good friend and we work closely together, but this has been his life's work. And he's really the rabbi of the Ethiopian Jewish community, Rav Menachem Waldman. And he, you know, one of the things that he's written about is that even those who converted to Christianity never fully accept Christianity. They lived almost like Anusim, like Maranos, you know. And they lived in isolated villages, even though they had converted to Christianity, they lived isolated. They never really intermarried. In my discussions with some of the community elders there, when I've visited Ethiopia, they've told me it's not that they did not want to assimilate and intermarry. The Ethiopians saw them as the other, Falash Mura. You know, they're the other. They're not accepted people. They're castaways. They used to call them hyenas. They saw them as predators, as scavengers, as subhuman. So even though they converted to Christianity and may have wanted to integrate, number one, they lived isolated in these farming villages in Eritrea and in northern Ethiopia. You could see them even to this day. You could see where their Bate Knesset were, these abandoned villages. And it's incredible how in recent decades this community has moved and left everything behind. And we'll come back to this a little later on this morning. They've left everything behind to come to these major centers in Gondar in the north and the nation's capital, Addis Ababa, in hopes to make Aliyah. And they've reclaimed their faith. And today, and I'll talk more about this a little later on this morning, today they have re-embraced Judaism and reclaimed their faith and are living as dedicated and passionate Jews. And they will all undergo conversion. We'll talk about conversion in a few moments. But this is what happens in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. These Christian missionaries begin aggressively targeting the Jewish community for conversion. And at the same time, there's a renewed interest in the plight of the Jews of Ethiopia by the Jewish community in Europe. And rabbis in Europe begin calling on Jews to travel there and to start teaching. And we have people in the late 19th and early 20th century that travel to Ethiopia to start educating the Jewish community and try to counter these missionary activities. In 1864, Rav Azriel Hildesheimer, who's a great rabbi, he led the Berlin Rabbinical Seminary. He issued a call to action to counter this missionary activity. In 1908, you had a letter signed by 43 prominent rabbis of Israel and the diaspora, encouraging the Jews of Ethiopia to be strong and steadfast in their faith. Again, visits to Ethiopia by Jewish scholars and educators follow. In 1912, Rav Kook writes a letter. This, by the way, is in print if anyone wants to see the letter. It's in the second volume of the Igrot HaRa'aya, the letters, the collected letters of Rav Kook. So Rav Kook himself writes a letter in 1912 expressing his support in sending teachers to Ethiopia to educate and strengthen the community and combat assimilation and missionary activities. And before and following the founding of the State of Israel, the status of Ethiopian Jews would once again begin to be discussed and debated to determine whether they would be eligible to immigrate under Israel's Chok HaShvut, the law of return. Okay, and so in 1951, Rav Herzog, the grandfather of today's president of Israel, Buzi Herzog, Isaac Herzog, who he's named for, of course. By the way, Buzi Herzog formerly served as the head of the Jewish Agency and worked very hard to try to bring Ethiopian Jews on Aliyah. So it's no surprise that in light of the current conflict, he would call on the State of Israel to bring the rest of Ethiopian's Jewish community on Aliyah. But his grandfather, for whom he named, serving as chief rabbi in 1951, was asked by the Jewish Agency to paskin, to rule on the status of Ethiopian Jewry. You know, are they Jews? Are they not Jews? Do they require conversion? Can we bring them on Aliyah? So Rav Herzog was very interesting. Rav Herzog, as some of you may know, he wrote a doctorate. He was absolutely brilliant, both as a posek, but also he was a scholar. He wrote a doctorate on Tchelet, trying to search for the Tchelet, for the Chilazon. And so Kedarka Bakodesh, he consults with, he doesn't just consult with the Tshuvot of the Radbaz, but consults with historians and sociologists and anthropologists who raise questions that were raised eyebrows. And in the letter that he writes in 1954, Rav Herzog debates their pedigree. And due to a number of concerns, concludes that they require full conversion. Now, part of Rav Herzog's hesitation was a concern for Mamzerut. Okay, now this is nothing new. The Radbaz in his Tshuvot already touches on this. Rav Herzog was concerned that since this community did not have a Torah Shebaal Peh as we do, and did not have a Mishnah, Gemara, right? While their marriages may be considered full-fledged halachic marriages, kiddushin, men and women living together as husband and wife, okay? In other words, even if they, didn't stand under a chuppah with a Masadar Kiddushin authorized by the chief rabbinate, husband and wife living together as husband and wife, you could view that halachically as a halachic union, as Kiddushin, but they did not have Gittin. They did not write Gittin, creating serious concerns for Mamzerut. Now, the truth is, members of the community will tell you that divorce wasn't really a thing in that community. So there's really not a concern that they didn't write Gittin. They didn't get divorced. I mean, people got married. You got married. It's not like today where there's such a high divorce rate. Okay. But conversion to Judaism, right, would wipe clean any potential problems with yichus and with lineage, with questions of mamzerut. So if you say, well, they're not Jews, so they get to start fresh, tabula rasa, okay? It wasn't really much done. Fast forward to the 1970s, and 20 years later, In February of 1973, Rav Ovadia Yosef ruled that the Beta Israel, the group which clung strongly to their faith for thousands of years, should be afforded full halachic status as Jews. He was asked by the government, I think it was Golda Meir, I think it was Golda Meir maybe at the time, but Rav Ovadia Yosef's ruling helped set in motion a chain of events that would change the government's attitude and policy towards Ethiopian Jewry and eventually lead to the dramatic airlifts of Operation Moses and Solomon. Okay, and in 1975, the Beta Israel community was officially recognized as Jewish by the State of Israel under the law of return. And in 1977, they began to arrive as Olim, which we'll talk about shortly. Now, this was a watershed moment. This psak, this ruling of Rav Ovadia Yosef had tremendous, tremendous significance. He ruled again that members of the Beta Israel, what they called at the time Falasha, did not require conversion. They are full-fledged Jews. There was a lot of controversy. But Kedarko Bakodesh, Rav Ovadia, and this is his style in Psak, bases himself on earlier sources. Rav Ovadia, if you look at any of his tshuvot, Rav Ovadia, with his encyclopedic mind, right, he cites all, and this is before computers, before you could do a search on Bar Ilan. In fact, one time they tried to see who's better, who knows more, Rav Ovadia or the computer. But Rav Ovadia, in his tshuvot, he cites all the precedents, all the halachic precedents, all the sources on a topic, and rules according to the majority oftentimes. And so here, he cites the Radbaz. Radbaz writes a number of tshuvot, as do others. The Radbaz accepted them as Jews. Rav Ovadia accepted them as Jews. Okay, it's a watershed moment, landmark tshuva, very, very important tshuva for the story of Ethiopian Jewry. Again, very controversial psak. But because of this, many in the Beta Israel saw and see Rav Ovadia as their posek. As many Ethiopian Jews follow Sephardic practice, follow the Piske Halacha of Rav Ovadia because he embraced them and he ruled that they were Jews. Unfortunately, as I said, it was a lot of backlash, a lot of debate and discussion. It was a big machloket, and many did not accept them. Many poskim did not, and said that they had to undergo a full conversion. Some members of the Beta Israel would undergo a type of conversion just to rule out any sfeikot, any doubts. The community that has trickled in recent decades, the Falashmura, those who converted to Christianity in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, and in recent decades, as I said, left their villages and re-embraced their faith, they all undergo conversion upon making Aliyah. And that's the current policy of the chief rabbinate, again, to rule out any questions. Rav Moshe Feinstein, we'll see in a moment, Tzitz Eliezer, Rav Eliezer Waldenberg, Rav Shach, Rav El Yashav, Rav Shlomo Zalman Arabach, and Diane Weiss, Rav Yitzchak Weiss, were all among the leading poskim who ruled that they undergo a conversion. Tzitz Eliezer actually has a tshuva in the 17th volume of the Tzitz Eliezer, where he collects all these opinions. And that becomes the official policy of the chief rabbinate. The Beta Israel, they say have a strong presumptive status as Jews, but still require conversion out of doubt. And then the Falashmura, the group that's currently waiting to make Aliyah and has made Aliyah in recent decades, they require a full conversion. Okay, and as you all know, you know, this is a dramatic story of their return home to Israel in the 1970s. They begin walking by foot through the Sudan towards Israel. These were people that were fleeing, again, a war-torn region, fleeing famine, starvation. There's an estimated over 4,000 who died on journey walking by foot, men, women, and children from starvation, thirst, exhaustion, and even violence from marauding groups and people. It begins in the late 70s, what is known as Operation Brothers, and members of the Beta Israel walking on foot into the Sudan, to these refugee camps, and then getting snuck into Israel by Mossad agents operating in Sudan, leading these covert operations known as Operation Brothers. There was a film that came out a couple of years ago called, I think, The Red Sea Diving Resort, if I'm not mistaken, which tells the story of how Israeli Mossad agents took over a resort on the Red Sea, and they evacuated Ethiopian Jews that way because the Sudan would not let them. It was this covert operation. They put them on boats and carried them towards Israel. I mean, just, you know, these heroic missions. And then, of course, so they began to trickle in already in the late 70s and early 80s. Operation Brothers was from 1979 to 1983. And then you have in 1984, Operation Moses. Now, again, responding to civil war and famine, by now you've got thousands of members of the Beta Israel in refugee camps in the Sudan. The Sudan did not have diplomatic relations with Israel. It's a Muslim country. And Israel carried out these covert operations, but the Sudanese really knew about it. They brought over 8,000 Jews on 30 flights over the course of 7 weeks. So you can't do that without drawing some attention. But what they did was they basically bribed the corrupt Sudanese government. That's how they were able to get away with it. So this, again, this takes place between November 1984 and January 1985. And they bring over 8,000 Jews on 30 flights from these refugee camps in Sudan. So this is the first major heroic airlift. But what happened? How did it stop? It stops abruptly when Prime Minister Shimon Peres goes on television and takes some of the the accolades for it. There's this press conference, and then once it reaches the press, then Sudan says, "Okay, we have to stop." In other words, we were willing to work with you when it was, you know, done quietly. And, they wink, wink, nudge, nudge, you know, they claimed they didn't know about it. Of course, they knew about it. They were bribed. But once it made the media, once it was reported in the news, so then on January 5th, the mission abruptly stopped, leaving some just about 1,000 behind. And then in 1985, that same year, the U.S. carried out Operation Joshua, where they brought about 650 of those that were left behind from the Sudan to Israel. The United States, they were somehow able to bargain a deal with Sudan, use their relations, use some diplomacy to make that happen. But the most dramatic and heroic airlift took place in 1981. That was Operation Solomon. And again, instability in the region, war-torn countries, and fearing that Ethiopian's government was about to be toppled, which could have been devastating, and maybe they would never be able to get the rest out. So on May 24th and 25th of 1991, Israel carried out this incredible Herculean effort, this dramatic, heroic airlift or series of airlifts, where they had nonstop flights, nonstop, for 36 hours. They flew 35 Israeli aircraft. Okay? 35 Israeli aircraft, Israeli Air Force C-130s, and El Al Boeing 747s. So those of you who don't like El Al, who complain about El Al's customer service, the flight crew, you know, they have a tremendous suit. Okay, they helped in transporting 14,325 Ethiopian Jews in 36 hours. In 36 hours from Ethiopia to Israel. 14,325. There were children born during those flights. They had to pull out, you know, you complain about leg room on El Al flights in economy class because you don't want to pay for premier economy or preferred seating, right? Or business. They pulled out all the seating to make room for the Olim. I mean, this is incredible. 14,325 Ethiopian Jews to Israel in 36 hours. That's less than 2 days. Only Israelis would have the chutzpah to try something like that. And in recent decades, Olim have trickled into Israel from the Falashmura, this group that I described to you. I remember once coming to Israel with a teen tour, a group of high schoolers from the United States as a madrich. And there we get to Ben Gurion Airport, and we are walking towards, I'm trying to think where this could have been, but some sort of parking lot at Ben Gurion Airport where there were buses. And there we are waiting to board our bus. And right next to us, hundreds of Olim from Ethiopia waiting to board their buses to their Merkazei Klita, their absorption centers. You know, with children in tow, barefoot, nothing but the clothes on their back. Okay. And today, as I said, there are about 5,500 waiting to make Aliyah in Gondar in the north and Addis Ababa, the nation's capital. These are people that I mentioned have left everything behind, everything they know, these rural farming villages, their communities, their homes, in hopes of making Aliyah. They live in squalor, in awful, awful conditions in Gondar and in Addis, in poverty, with very, very limited, minimal access to work, to medicine, all sorts of social and economic challenges that they face. As I said, they are dubbed Falashmura, the other outsiders. They're seen as outsiders, not only by the Beta Israel, which I mentioned, but even by the Ethiopians. They're not welcomed. They're not embraced. It's very difficult for them. The young people who I'm in touch with all the time, Baruch Hashem for Facebook and WhatsApp and all of these things, they relate to me how they get bullied in school and get beaten up. We are careful not to go and visit their homes. We meet in the Jewish Community Center, which is basically this makeshift Beit Knesset and building called Tikvat Zion, where they have classrooms and you know, if anyone's interested, I can send you some video that I've taken there on my visits. It's just incredible to see on a Sunday morning when the entire community comes. They can't all come on Shabbat. They don't all live there. The Tikvat Zion in Addis Ababa, the Beit Knesset, and the classrooms there, the building that they have is right by the Israeli embassy there. The embassy building, it's in the same area. It's in an area not too far from the airport known as Yekka. And that area is considered a more expensive area. I mean, it's, you know, you walk around and it's poverty and it's squalor, really. That's the truth. But many of them live too far away to get there on Shabbos. But on Sunday morning, the entire community comes and you see them, hundreds of people there. They come to daven and to learn, and they have all sorts of classes where they're learning Hebrew in preparation for their aliyah. And as I said, this Rabbi Waldman has young people he sends on shlichut there. And the young people of the community, the teenagers of the community teach. They teach the adults, they teach the children, they teach Hebrew, they teach Torah. It's very incredible. It's very impressive. But they face all sorts of challenges, and the pandemic has been very difficult for them, and most recently this war that's taking place in the north now with rebel troops advancing towards the nation's capital. Really, their fate is hanging in the balance, but. As I said, we don't go to their homes. I got off on a tangent there. I was saying we don't go to their homes. One of the reasons is because when the Ethiopian neighbors see, you know, white affluent Jews visiting them, they'll raise their rents on them. Stories I've heard of kidnappings where babies, children were taken and held for ransom. And these are people that don't have anything to begin with. you know, there's like an Israeli embassy that's blocks long. It's a huge, huge embassy. It's certainly the largest embassy that I've ever seen abroad. And what are they doing? I don't really know. You know, they're only allowing them to trickle in. That's been the policy. And certainly they're not helping them day to day with these social and economic challenges that they face with poverty, with you know, minimal access to health. It's very sad. It's very sad. On one of my trips there, there was at the time, this young couple, this newly married couple, these newlyweds from Efrat, who were there on Shlichut for about half a year. And they shared with me that they were getting ready to go back home to Israel. They were completing their Shlichut. And they shared with me how one of the mothers begged them to take their little toddler, their little girl back with them. Here, take her, keep her. I can't feed her. I can't care for her. It was just heartbreaking. It's just heartbreaking. And as I said, in November of 2015, there was a formal hachlata, I think hachlata 717, if I'm not mistaken, something like that, 707, 717. The Knesset voted to bring the rest of the Ethiopian Jews on Aliyah. Okay? We know who they are. The embassy has a record. We know their names. We know who they are. If Israel can airlift 14,325 Ethiopian Jews in a matter of 36 hours in 1991, certainly they can bring the 5,500 that are left. And unfortunately, the policy, and I don't know why this is, but has been to, you know, to take some members of the family, but not others. Almost everyone that I've met when I've visited, they already have immediate family living here in Israel that have been accepted on Aliyah. Okay, but the policy, for instance, is they'll take the mother and the younger children, but the older children, the older daughter who's married, they won't accept right away on Aliyah. And so the policy has been to split up families, separate families. Also heartbreaking, just heartbreaking. They'll take, you know, the young, able-bodied men, but the older people and the small children, they'll leave. Now, you know, certainly the adjustment, the absorption, life has not been easy for the Ethiopian community here in Israel. And it's certainly very expensive because it's not just a matter of bringing them on Aliyah, but, you know, basically educating them and training them. And for the older people, you know, it's not really much that they can do when they get here. And that has led to all sorts of social economic problems and challenges even here in the state of Israel. Poverty, alcoholism, discrimination, all sorts of social ills that they never really faced in Ethiopia. There was never alcoholism. There was never drug addiction in Ethiopia. Clashes with police. You may remember the story, the most recent story in July of 2019, heartbreaking. There was an off-duty police officer in Kiryat Chaim in North Haifa who came to a park, brought his wife and three small children to a playground, and he sees some teenagers fighting and beating up a younger boy and trying to break it up. There was some sort of skirmish, some sort of melee, and in the midst of it all, he discharged his weapon on the ground, but the bullet ricocheted and killed a 12-year-old boy, Solomon Teka. An 18-year-old boy, I apologize, an 18-year-old boy who came to Israel when he was 12. He'd grown up in Gondar, moved with his family in about 2013 when he was 12. But this 18-year-old boy was killed, and there was all sorts of rioting and clashes with police. And in 2020, in February of 2020, this police officer was indicted for negligent homicide. But you know, all sorts of challenges and problems, and certainly life has not been easy for them. But you have to ask the question, who has failed them? Who has failed them? After one of my visits, to Ethiopia, I came back to this yeshiva that I was teaching at in Mivaseret, and one of the rabbis there, he asked, come on, are they really Jews? Look at the Merkaz Klita, the absorption center here in Mivaseret, which is home to members of the Ethiopian community. He says, I see the way young people behave and act. And I said, well, I asked him, whose fault is that? Whose fault is that? Who has failed them? If you go to Ethiopia today, you'll see a Jewish community that is deeply dedicated to their Judaism. You know, that is waiting to come on Aliyah, that is madly in love with the God above, that is madly in love with the God of Israel, the Torah of Israel, the people of Israel, and even the state of Israel, with all that the state has done or not done for them. But before we end, I just want to conclude by looking with you together at a tshuva of Rav Moshe Feinstein. Because again, the question is, are they Jews? Aren't they Jews? Are they opportunists? How should we relate to them? So this is a tshuva that Rav Moshe Feinstein writes. It's printed in the fifth chelek of the Even HaEzer. Okay, he's writing both about the status of Ethiopian Jewry and the Jews from India. But take a look where I've underlined. Now, Rav Moshe ruled that Ethiopian Jews require conversion. Okay, as I said, all those coming on Aliyah do convert. Anyone questions their status? But he writes, Aval Adina Kashe Lismocha. So he quotes the Tshuvot of the Radbaz, which Rav Avadia Yosef accepted. Rav Avadia Yosef accepted this tradition that was recorded in the Tshuvot of the Radbaz, where the Radbaz says this community is Jewish, does not require conversion. Rav Moshe says it's very difficult to rely on those Tshuvot. Shelo barur im haRadbaz yada hetev hamitziyut odotam. It's not clear whether the Radbaz really understood and investigated the mitzius, you know, the history, the veracity, the authenticity of these traditions, the historicity of these people. The gam lo barur im ad zmanenu lo nishtane matzavam. This is also unclear whether from then until now their status has not changed, right? You know, the Radbaz is relying on a tradition from the 9th century of Eldad Hadani. So between the 9th century to the 16th century and the 16th century to the 20th century, Rav Moshe writes, it's very difficult to know whether their status has changed. But this is key. Take a look where I've underlined next. V'lagabei yahadutam nechshav lanu kesafek. Concerning their Jewishness, it's a safek, it's a doubt. V'yesh latzricham gerut amiti kodem she natiram lavo bekal. And therefore they require a full conversion before we can allow them to marry into the Jewish people. But look where what I've put in bold. This is essential. Aval gam kodem gerutam yesh mitzvah lahatzilam nishmad umisakana kidin kol Yisrael. This is incredible. But nevertheless, even before their conversion to Judaism, there is a mitzvah to save them from being forcibly converted, from shmad, okay, from these missionary activities, umisakana, and from danger, kidin kol Yisrael. In other words, bring them on Aliyah. Okay, they're starving. There's the threat of violence, the threat of forced conversions. Shesafek nefashot lahakel. We have a principle that even in a situation where there is a doubt, where there's a safek, we say safek nefashot lahakel. We are lenient. Gam shekana safek havei be'etzem yichusam kiyadim. Even if in this particular case the safek is concerning their status as Jews, nevertheless we have to err on the side of caution. We say safek nefashot lahakel. We invoke this principle of safek nefashot lahakel, erring on the side of caution and saving them. It's a mitzvah to save them. And here, v'gam yesh ladat shafilu im ledina inam yudim. Even if maybe technically they're not Jews, according to halacha, mikol makom, and this is such an important line, nevertheless, me'achar shechoshvim shehem yudim, u'mosrim nafsham al yahadutam, m'chuyavim lahatzilam. Since they consider themselves Jews, they self-identify as Jews and have sacrificed so much for their Judaism. Rav Moshe writes, "Mechuyavim lahatzam." We are obligated to save them. It is a mitzvah to save them, to bring them on Aliyah. Okay, skip to where I've underlined next. Now he deals with the concern in the state of Israel that they are assimilating. What about assimilation? What about marrying with them? Aval in nitgayru kidin, if they convert kidin, according to Jewish law, ukimoshe shamati shosim, as I've heard is being done, nechshavam kichol yehudim, they should be considered full-fledged Jews. V'yesh la'uzram ulatomcham b'chol tzorchei chayim, and we have to assist them and support them in all sorts of matters of life. again, well, social economic challenges that they face, well, we have to address those. Bein begashmiut, bein beruchniut. Whether it's their physical needs or their spiritual needs. Umaod needs to arti al mashe shamati sheish keelu be'eretz Yisrael she monim yilikarvam be'inyanei ruchaniyut. And it pains me to hear that there are those in Israel who refuse to embrace them and bring them in spiritually and educate them. Why? The gormim chaz v'shalom shiyu avudim midat yudi, and they cause about that they are going to be lost to the Jewish religion. They're going to assimilate. V'nir Ali, and he says, and I understand why. It appears to me, shekach nogim rak mishum shetzeva oram hu shachor. It appears to me that the reason why they are failing to embrace this community is because their skin is black. Racism. Okay. Discrimination. Depashut sheyesh l'kavram. Simply, we have to embrace them. Lo rak mitzad shenam gorim yishar yudim. Gruimi Shayudim. Not because they're no worse than any other Jews. If they convert to Judaism, they should be accorded all that we accord to any Jew. Halacha doesn't make any distinction based on color of one's skin. We have a mitzvah of loving the ger, loving the convert. And then he concludes that we should be zocha to see the fulfillment of the prophecy of the ingathering of the exiles. Okay, so Rav Moshe here in this tshuva, he rules that while yes, they require a full-fledged conversion to Judaism to rule out any questions, any sfeikot, any doubts, but nevertheless, once they convert, we afford full Jewish status to them. We have the mitzvah of v'ahavtem et hager. We have to love them. We have to embrace them. We have to educate them. We have to take care of them, both spiritually and physically, he writes, gashmius, ruchnius. And he adds, and this is so important, even before they convert, we have a mitzvah to save them. Because this is a community that, whether they're technically Jewish or not, has identified for centuries with the Jewish people. They've cast their lot with the Jewish people, with the fate of the Jewish nation. They self-identify as Jews. They were moser nefesh. They've sacrificed so much, as we described this morning, for their Judaism. So we have a mitzvah, he writes, to save them. Now, in Yeshayahu Perek Yud Aleph, and we'll end with this, source number 4, the prophet Isaiah Yeshayahu describes how we're going to see an ingathering of the exiles from Ashur, from Mitzrayim, from Patros, from Cush, Elim, Shinar, all these places. Cush, of course, is Ethiopia. Are we indeed seeing the fulfillment of the prophecy of the ingathering of the exiles in our day? Maybe. Maybe. You know, there is a debate among Chazal as to the status of the 10 lost tribes. According to one opinion, the 10 lost tribes, they never returned. They were lost to the dustbin of history and will never return. According to another, they returned before the Second Temple was destroyed. They returned together with the Jewish people before the first temple was destroyed, before the second temple was destroyed. They returned, so they're still among us. They had already returned. According to another opinion, they are going to return as righteous converts. So we could very well be seeing the fulfillment of the prophecy of the ingathering of the exiles. So it doesn't have to present a challenge that this community undergoes conversion to rule out any sfeikos, any doubts, any questions with regards to their pedigree. Could be a fulfillment of what Chazal said, that it's possible that the 10 lost tribes will ultimately return as Geirei Tzedek.